Mr. Sherman Crawford?
The litigation of immigration law is a difficult enough process. It's an extremely unusual courtroom setting for those of whom are used to either a civil process or a criminal process, as we heard earlier in the morning. The immigration judge becomes an opponent in the sense that with the ability to question the respondent before them, you spend more time as a practitioner dealing with the judge than you actually do with the government attorney. Well, in this matter, it becomes even more compounded when you walk into court and there's evidence presented by the judge, absent any statutory authority, that you've not had time to prepare for. However, in this particular case, the government had at least a day by the fact sheet to prepare for that very evidence. And so what is a difficult proceeding becomes a highly prejudicial one, especially in the sense when it appears through the statutory changes that occurred after 1996, Congress intended to make this a more traditional adversarial climate in the sense that the judge becomes a neutral and detached magistrate, or at least that attempt, because they now no longer have the ability to introduce evidence. And so that disappears when the judge is now introducing evidence that is contrary, arguably, to the position that you're trying to put forth, which then leads one to question the true partiality of that immigration judge. That becomes hampered as an appellate attorney when you can't get the exhibits from the Board of Immigration Appeals. They are the keeper of the record. Luckily, in many cases, you have attorneys you can get the documents from, but in this case, the Board of Immigration Appeals refused to provide that documentation. And so that it becomes an even greater matter of now preparing an adequate appellate defense or an appellate argument when you can't obtain that evidence that the judge put in. The BIA blithely notes in their opinion that it's available on the internet. I'd ask the panel member to return and try and look up things on USCIS's own website. It just recently underwent change. You can't find anything on it. One, it's a poorly designed website, but that's an aside. The issue is that many old documents and many old sites don't exist anymore. Many of the old federal registers that used to be out, for example, under TPS, they used to carry everything that had ever been put out regarding TPS. Those sites simply don't exist anymore, regardless of how you try to go back to find them. So in many cases, information that's gleaned is used, especially from news sources. Those get updated, the old ones get taken off, and they're simply not accessible anymore. There is prejudice in this matter. Notwithstanding, you're now facing an immigration judge who is arguably partial by the nature of the evidence put forward, but the prejudice occurs in this case in an interesting way. The government argues there's no prejudice. The State Department reports are overwhelmingly against the petitioner's position. The trouble begins when you look at what the State Department report says. The government loves to rely on a State Department report and says, see, it excludes what your petitioner is claiming. But they rarely do. There's rarely a State Department report that says this act cannot happen. In this case, it says usually that FGM is usually practiced on young children and adolescents. Usually. Well, that's not an absolute. And the question becomes here, the statute allows for credible testimony to present a case. There's no adverse credibility finding in this case by the immigration judge. She doubts testimony. She points out different cases to say there may be corroboration when there's doubt, but she doesn't make a specific adverse credibility finding in this matter. So the question becomes, if you have someone who's from that country and from those experiences, and you haven't ruled them to be incredible, does their testimony carry weight over a loosely worded State Department report that says usually? In many cases, in all cases, FGM is a social tool from a male-dominated society to control women, whether they are adolescents and the desire to protect virginity or they are adult women and the desire to curb adultery. Regardless of its application, it's a 1,400-year-old practice that still continues. In Kenya recently, within the last decade, there was a rise of the Mungiki, a socio-religious cult that rose up and took some political power. There's currently a battle with them. It's relevant in this argument in that the Mungiki were were a throwback to past religious beliefs, past social beliefs, past cultural beliefs. They brought back and tried to push forward FGM to say anybody who hasn't in the past now needs to because it's the right thing to do. I've jokingly pointed out in other arguments before immigration judges that it's not unlike our own reach back during the last 8 years to a retreat to family values and values of the 1950s, where we look back in the past and say we have problems now, and they're because we've changed what we used to do. And so FGM is a very old tradition, and in many times it becomes the standard of the problems in today's society. We've gotten away with the ways of the past, so now we're going to move forward. So therefore, it is not unusual, or it is not incredible to believe that these values could have been perpetrated on this woman, that her family could have moved forward and said, now it's the time. Now it's the time to adopt these old social values, and you must undergo this act. There is no act in Cameroon making FGM illegal. It doesn't exist. They criticize it, but they do nothing about it because they understand the strength of old social values. And in those countries, it's very difficult to contain and control the masses. The government is more typically interested in exploiting reserves of the countries than they are in truly controlling the society. If there are no questions, I'd reserve some time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharma Crawford. Mr. Holyoke, is it?
May it please the Court, my name is Dallin Riley Holyoke, and I'm a trial attorney with the U.S. Department of Justice. I represent the Attorney General of the United States in this petition for review. I'm asking this Court to deny this petition for review. The answer to this petition is clear. Ms. Agbor's claim was unpersuasive, and she has failed to prove prejudice from any of the errors that she alleges. This failure cripples her due process claim. Moreover, this panel should be aware that Ms. Agbor received significant due process. She enjoyed no less than 3 opportunities to present her claim, first to the asylum officer, next to the immigration judge, and last to the board. All 3 found her claim unconvincing. Moreover, she was represented by counsel at each of these steps, guiding her through the process and helping her develop her claim. Importantly, Ms. Agbor has taken no... Yes.
Just interrupt you if I can. Mr. Sharma Crawford's position is that an in-country report at best is generalized. And, you know, we get them all the time that conditions are improving in X or Y country. When you have a situation as arguably as egregious under our approach to culture, as is alleged here, Can we take the normal reliance on an in-country report about a trend line of improving conditions when we have the fact situation as alleged here?
Well, Your Honor, the government would hold that a country report is very persuasive evidence. And, in fact, this circuit has held that it takes a great deal of evidence to overturn a country report. In fact, a state report, in this case, we have more than just the state report. We have the State Department report on country and human rights practices. We also have the State Department report on asylum cases. In addition, we have the applicant's own testimony, which the immigration court found to lack persuasion and not to bear her burden of proof.
So is it the government's position that because the practice here is on a decline or is in a minority status, that should be persuasive?
I think, Your Honor, with all due respect, I think the position of the government is more that she does not fit into that class of individuals who would be subjected to FGM. The government's not unsympathetic to women who do suffer FGM in Africa. And I think that's important to point out. The immigration judge in this case did find that women who suffer FGM constitute a particular social group. It was not the issue in the end. The issue is whether or not this applicant was actually part of that class of individuals who would suffer FGM. And if you look at the State Department report, State Department report points out that in general, and in most cases, FGM is practiced on infants and pre-adolescents, on pre-adolescent girls, and even more so amongst the Muslim community as opposed to the Christian community. Ms. Agbor didn't fit this classification. She was also a married female. Now, it does seem, and the immigration judge pointed out and the board held, that it does seem that if FGM was practiced on individuals such as who fit Ms. Agbor's fit her profile, then you would think that somewhere in the State Department report or somewhere in some report, somebody would have at some point mentioned that married women are actually subjected to FGM. And as in all asylum cases, Ms. Agbor bared the burden of proof. It was her responsibility to come into court and to convince the court that she would suffer FGM if returned to Cameroon. It was not the court's responsibility to find reasons why she didn't merit this relief. It was her responsibility to come into court and prove that she did. And as I mentioned earlier, not only did she go into the asylum officer and try to prove this and fail because they found her claim unpersuasive, she went to the immigration judge. They also, after a full hearing, and as is unusual in most immigration cases, you don't usually have a decision that is this long and this detailed. The immigration judge took this into serious consideration. She thought about this, and she said, well, FGM is a particular social group, but Ms. Agbor doesn't fit this claim. She didn't believe her.
And there were two. One was a Canadian in-country report, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Was that pretty much the same as the U.S. report?
The Canadian report, and as it's good to point out, the Canadian report actually helped petitioner because the U.S. State Department report said the incidence of FGM in Cameroon is less than 5%. The Canadian report wasn't inherently adverse and therefore, as we argue, could not have possibly been prejudicial because it actually helped her make her claim that the FGM is practiced in Cameroon and it is more than 5%. Moving on next to the due process.
So then your response in terms of, you know, the fact that counsel didn't see it, the report, until the day of the hearing is that there was no prejudice because that Canadian report was more favorable?
Yes, Your Honor, that's one of our points. We do believe that the Canadian report could not have been prejudicial because after it was entered by the immigration judge, and if that was a mistake, the board did recognize that it could have been a mistake. It didn't actually prejudice her entire hearing. Now, no judicial proceeding is perfect, and we recognize that. The circuits have recognized that. But at the same time, Ms. Agbor's entire claim wasn't prejudiced. The immigration judge felt that she was offering evidence that would be useful to both sides. And if you actually look at the record, it was useful to both sides. Her attorney cited it in his closing argument. And moreover, unlike a lot of other immigration cases, there wasn't an oral decision at the end of this. There were 2 months after the end of the hearing for her attorney to actually object, to say something, anything about this report if he felt that it was prejudicial or if he felt there was ex parte contact. He didn't object during the hearing. He didn't ask for a continuance. He didn't even ask for a recess. And then he used it in his closing statements. 2 months passed, nothing happened. They didn't object until it got to the Board of Immigration Appeals. The Board of Immigration Appeals looked at it, took it into consideration, and looked in the entire case and decided that it didn't prejudice her entire claim.
Well, isn't it a little odd that the BIA didn't consider this letter from the Cameroonian social worker that supported the claim that FGM was widely practiced in her tribe?
Your Honor, I did look at that letter, and what I thought when I looked at that letter is I realized the BIA has a great number of cases. They consider the most relevant and important evidence, and when they likely looked at that letter because they had the entire record before them, it obviously wasn't that moving. And also, if you think about this letter,
well, of course, they didn't mention it at all.
Right, they
so
didn't mention.
So we don't know whether it was moving or not.
That's correct. They didn't mention it. Obviously, it didn't make it into their opinion. But on that, the government also feels there is a vast amount of evidence in the record, aside from this letter, which also showed that it didn't support her claim. Also, it's from a social worker. It wasn't from an expert in Cameroonian women's issues. It was from somebody who happened to have lived in Cameroon. And on that point, it didn't make her an expert. And this circuit has upheld. It takes a great deal of evidence. In fact, the circuit has said possibly an expert to overturn to contradict a State Department report. Country reports are very, very persuasive. And in this case, there are country reports which actually uphold the government's position. Also, something else that I want to mention it because Petitioner's Counsel got to it was the question of whether or not the BIA was required to provide the record. to petitioner. And clearly, this is really a non-issue for this court. Ms. Agbor's claim that she was prejudiced in preparing her appeal to the board by guidelines that only require the board to provide her with the transcript but allow the board to review the entire record is essentially a non-issue and should be recognized as such. As the board explained, regardless of whether Ms. Agbor retained a new attorney, the board's guidelines do not require it to copy and send the entire record. Moreover, Ms. Agbor disputes this mechanism, but fails to mention that basic common sense would dictate that she could have and she should have obtained a copy of her file from her previous attorney. That was her responsibility. In fact, she admits that she did, in fact, obtain a copy of her file from her previous attorney. Moreover, all the documents of which she requested are widely available public documents. All that aside, it is important to reveal to this court that the board practice manual does contain a mechanism that provided her access to her file, which she failed to utilize or to mention. Chapter 1.5, subpart D, fraction I and triple I of the board practice manual provides for parties to a removal proceeding to go to the immigration court, request to review their file, and allows them to make copies of it for the record. This is a non-issue. Moving on to the issue of past persecution. It's Ms. Agbor's burden of proof to persuade the agency that she qualifies for asylum and withholding of removal, and she failed to do so on three separate occasions. Although Ms. Agbor argues that she demonstrated past persecution, the asylum officer, the immigration judge, and the board did not agree. And their findings are consistent with precedent of this circuit finding unfulfilled death threats not to constitute past persecution. Ahmed versus Ashcroft in 2003, Hernandez Baena versus Gonzalez in 2005, and Boyka versus INS in 1997.
Now, look, I'm going to have to ask you to conclude your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. The agency has made a discretionary determination that Ms. Agbor does not merit asylum, withholding of removal, or protection under the Convention Against Torture, and that decision must be upheld, unless evidence compels this court otherwise. Three stages of review have found that it does not. Moreover, while no judicial proceeding is perfect, no judicial proceeding can possibly be perfect, any alleged errors below did not result in prejudice to Ms. Agbor's claim, and therefore no due process violation has been properly demonstrated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holyoke. Mr. Sharma Crawford.
Counsel wants you to believe that if there was an error, it's not a big deal. I would submit to this court that at any point when you walk into a courtroom expecting neutrality and impartiality, and the judge demonstrates neither, that it becomes...
Well, this demonstration of impartiality, what specifically do you point to? I mean, IJs do have the ability and regularly do questioning. There's no...
I fully agree.
Sit on an appellate court very long to realize that. And sometimes it seems overly aggressive, certainly, to counsel for the petitioner. But what here is it that you would point to that specifically that crosses the line, at least under our cases?
At this point, you have an immigration judge who has before her, before the court, the application of the appellant. And she goes out to find evidence to this case. One, that she's not statutorily allowed to do. There is no authority for that.
We've suggested in some of our case law that fairly recently that IJs need to be better informed about in-country situations. And as you know, our circuit's been pretty aggressive in this area. So that an IJ comes prepared and therefore leads to more questioning, obviously, if he or she is better prepared in the area. How is that to be viewed as impartial, not being impartial?
Well, an IJ to be prepared is one thing. To have an understanding of the world around them is one thing. But to come with documentary evidence that's contrary or one-sided, partial, I can only give an example. If you were in a civil courtroom and that judge came with a Dun & Bradstreet of one of the companies that was disfavored to one of the parties and didn't have something on the other side. At this point, all of the evidence that the immigration judge brought was counterweighted against a claim, was not broad.
So you would prefer that the immigration judge read the report and not advise counsel at the hearing about it?
I would.
I
would prefer
that
we present evidence to the court. I mean, we're required, the Chicago court has a 10-day rule for evidence. Sometimes the judges require it 2 to 3 weeks in advance, a month in advance, depending on who the IJ is. We present country reports. We present articles from the Internet, news articles and all of that. That is the evidence for the court to consider. We've brought the case. I don't dispute the court's opinion that the immigration judge should be familiar and be able to understand the balance, but the evidence is what we bring. That's the matter to the table.
So do you have any authority that precludes or prohibits the IJ from getting something? Like, I could understand it if it was just some article that nobody ever heard of, but here it's a country report.
I understand.
So this isn't, just something the immigration judges pulled up out of thin air.
Well, the balance then becomes, one, we've created a slippery slope, and that by that I mean there are immigration judges who, in this case, it's a Canadian report that's available off of the Internet. There are other country reports that are by membership only that immigration judges are wont to use. Where's the balance? Do I now have to pay because I know this immigration judge uses a pay service?
Were you precluded from responding to this report or asking for some additional time?
I wasn't the trial attorney.
The trial attorney did. The trial attorney didn't ask for additional time to respond.
He could have, but in this case, I don't know that he would have gotten any further. And clearly, as the government pointed out, he responded, but I think he would have been wholly derelict had he not responded to some degree. But one, we don't know if that's the best Canadian report. We don't know if it's the most. We don't know if it's most recent or if there's a newer Canadian report. He didn't have the time to do that. And as clogged as the immigration court's calendars are, I'm sure the immigration judge would have given him leave to do something in the future, but you've lost the impact of the moment. It's my belief that if Congress, and clearly by changing, and I understand my time is out, and I'll conclude with this, Congress has clearly intended to take away the ability of an immigration judge to introduce evidence. I don't dispute that the immigration judges should be knowledgeable, but hearing us come before them time after time gives them quite a world view if any time you sit in their docket. The ability to go out and research is not their job. It's our job to present them with the evidence and to review what they bring them. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sharmer Crawford. Mr. Holyoke, thank you. The case is taken under advisement.